The Spotlight.
And welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, the U.S. is seeking to reactivate Daesh terrorists in the West Asian region. This is according to the leader of the Lebanese resistance movement, Hezbollah. Sayed Hassan Nasrallah gave his condolences for the terror attacks in Iran, Syria, Pakistan, and Afghanistan, which all took place recently. On Sunday, August the 13th, the Shah Cheragh Shrine in Shiraz, Iran, was attacked by terrorists. Two people were killed and several others injured. It was the second attack on the shrine in 10 months. And on Friday, at least 30 Syrian soldiers were killed by Daesh terrorists. And prior to that, both Afghanistan and Pakistan have witnessed heinous terrorist attacks, leaving tens of people dead. Who is really behind these attacks and why? Well, I'd like to welcome my guests to this program. Saad al-Mutallabi, Iraqi politician and former political advisor to the Iraqi government. And Robert Fantina, author and journalist out of Ontario. Thank you both for being with me. Let's start this off in Baghdad. Saad, the leader of the Lebanese resistance has said that the U.S. wants to reactivate its Daesh project. What are your thoughts on that?
Thank you very much. Yes, it would be a very natural process. We have to remember the history of Daesh and previous to that, Al-Qaeda, which was created in Afghanistan by Saudi money and American instruction, and it was actually administered by the Americans and financed by the Saudis. And Al-Qaeda was, at the time, known as the Arab fighters who were helping in fighting the Soviet Union at the time when they occupied Afghanistan. And hence that word Al-Qaeda, which means the base, became a well-known name. And after the deceased of issues in Afghanistan, these forces moved back into Saudi Arabia and were distributed in the Arab world and some Islamic countries, and then became developed into ISIS, Daesh. And the story then, we all know how the Americans assisted or stopped or refused to assist the Iraqi army in attacking ISIS, Daesh, and allowed Daesh a full year to establish their caliphate and to establish, destroy ISIS, Daesh. Now the Americans are trying to reuse this instrument, which proved to be very successful and very efficient and active in destabilizing countries that have a variety of Islamic faiths, different sects. And ISIS, the Americans, are using this again as they used it in Iraq, as they used it in Syria, and now we see that it has been used again in other countries, including Iran. Hence, we do need a more active, a more cooperation on a security level, on intelligence level, and exchange of information on those terrorists.
Let me get Robert in on this conversation. Stay with me, Saad. Well, Robert, Washington denies that it supports terrorism and it supports Daesh. However, we have seen the U.S. protect thousands of Daesh terrorists and other terrorists in northeast Syria, or drop supplies to them or evacuate them at various times in various places, whether we're talking about Iraq or Afghanistan or Syria. So what does it all mean? On the one hand, the U.S. says that it actually fights against terrorism, fights against Daesh. But on the other hand, we have witnesses, we have various situations that have taken place that shows the opposite.
The
United States government has always wanted to portray its around the world. This, of course, is now and always has been a lie. The United States is not interested in a peaceful Middle East, certainly. It wants the continued disruption in that part of the country in order to maintain its control over much of the Middle East. The fact that it is irrefutable that the United States supports ISIS or Daesh and many other terrorist groups, it is the fact that those the evidence is there means nothing to the talking heads from Washington who want to say, no, we the United States opposes Daesh, the United States supports legally democratically elected governments. The United States is forever overthrowing democratically elected governments, supporting terrorist organizations within countries that have democratically elected governments, if those governments, for one reason or another, don't do U.S. bidding. And as far as financing terrorist organizations, the United States sends over $4 billion every year to Israel, and Israel and the IDF are among the main terrorist organizations in the Middle East. So the United States has this image it wants to portray to the world, but that image is not believed much outside of U.S. borders.
Was that, in your perspective, does the U.S. actually consider Daesh a terrorist group, and does Washington want to see this terrorist group disappear? Would it really like for it to regain its strength?
No, for domination, for complete domination of the Middle East and the Near East, the Americans are using Daesh as a tool, as a very effective tool. So the ploy, the joke that the Americans have forces in the region to fight terrorism, it's really a joke because they are fueling the terrorists. We have videos of American helicopters and American planes dropping aid to ISIS in Iraq. We have actual videos of them dropping aid and ammunition and supplies. So the point of the trying to make that this tool, it's really terrorist. No, the Americans know very well that this is a very effective and a deniable issue that they can deny at any time that they are assisting the terrorists. But in reality, it is an American-made and it is still being used as a tool to destabilize the region for a full American domination of the region. And we see some changes now, relationship in regional, between regional powers, Iran, Saudi, Turkey, and other countries. We see a movement away from the US dollars now in Turkey. The main exchange bureaus in Turkey will not deal in dollars anymore, and that's today. So we have this change, and America will definitely keep using this tool, the terrorism tool, and in particular the ISIS tool that they created themselves.
Interesting point that you've just made, Saad. And Robert, I want to pick up on some of the points that Saad just made with these alliances, these growing alliances that we have seen in the region, or talks about various alliances. Your analysis of how this will affect it all, because Saad said that for sure the U.S. will continue to use this terrorist element as these various countries try to get closer. Do you see them, U.S. actually becoming more aggressive in trying to make sure that these alliances are not solidified?
Yes, I think so, definitely. The United States is not pleased when countries throughout the Middle East begin to gain more peaceful alliances and agreements. The alliance between, of course, Iran and Saudi Arabia, which happened a few months ago, was very displeasing to the United States because it wanted to keep that tension there, which helps to destabilize the entire region. So if these countries, in wanting to have a peaceful country and a peaceful region, continue to reach out to each other. Of course, the alliance, Iran-Saudi alliance, is going a long way to ending the aggression against Yemen. So it's bringing there's a potential for a much more peaceful Middle East through this. That's not in keeping with the U.S. geopolitical goals. There has to be disruption. There has to be chaos. There has to be a violence in order for the United States to maintain control and to enable Israel to maintain the strength that it has throughout the Middle East.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Saad, the UN has condemned the attack which took place in Iran on Sunday night, and so has the European Union. Your thoughts on the duplicity, first by the UN, which condemns the terrorist act, but allows the terrorists to be in Syria, and the European Union itself, when it allows and supports terrorists to live in Europe, like the MKO or MEK?
Well, we can't really rely on European opinion anymore, political opinion anymore, because they've proven that they have to obey whatever American orders is given to them. And we can see the issue in the Ukraine and how the Europeans are suffering, and we see the United Kingdom within a really, really dire straits, and but still they are obeying whatever the Americans would tell them. The same story in the way they treat the Palestinian nation, and they call them terrorists, while the real terrorists, the Israeli forces, which are the illegal occupiers of Palestinian land, are called commandos, where the Palestinian freedom fighters are called terrorists. And that double standard that the Europeans do applies again in Syria, applies again in Iraq, in Iran, and Pakistan maybe, and any other country that the Americans think that they need to strengthen their domination of the region. So really, the Europeans are just became a tool in the world map, in the bigger game that the Americans are playing, and trying to keep some form of domination. We all know that the American nation, as a country, is losing power, and losing power very fast, with internal problems that probably will become unsolvable in the very near future. But they are trying to somehow export their problems overseas, and export the issues that are, it's always war make money for the industrial states. So they try to create further money so countries will buy further military hardware. Hence, this will help somehow. They think that this will help somehow the American economy. So it's all tied together. The European, the Americans, they're all in the same game. World domination, not allowing the people of the world to gain their freedom and their responsibility and their self-determination.
World domination and not allowing the people of the world to gain their freedom. Robert, I mean, let's talk about that side of things. Do you think that, as we see countries in the global south and also the sphere of resistance trying to distance themselves from Washington, and also trying to distance themselves from the dollar little by little, do you think that we're going to see an increase in these type of attacks, especially if Washington is behind them, or your assessment of that?
Yes, I think there will be, sadly, an increase in these. As Mr. Assad said, the United States is losing its power and influence in the world and is racked with internal problems. Currently, the former president has had 4 indictments and is facing something like 80 felony charges, and it's caused great division in the United States, in addition to the racist policies of the government and so on. So it is a government that is clinging to power in the world, and like a wounded animal is particularly dangerous. The United States at this point is particularly dangerous. It's always been dangerous, but right now, as countries are moving away, as you said, countries in the global south are moving away from the dollar. They're moving away from trade agreements with the United States and seeking such agreements with other countries in the world, other industrialized or developed countries. And the United States does not want to see this happen because it will, again, as Mr. Assad said, threaten its global domination. The United States wants the natural resources of the world for itself, to enrich the already rich leaders of the country and the other rich people in the country. It wants to assure that it has the largest piece of the pie, if I could say it in that way. And the way to do that is by forcing governments to do its bidding, regardless of how brutal those governments might be, how much they violate international law and repress their own people. We see that certainly in Israel and in a number of other places. And a major example is when the United States in the 50s overthrew the democratic elected government of Iran and installed and supported a very brutal leader in that country until the people rose up and overthrew the Shah. But the United States has since that time, since the overthrow, since the Iranian Revolution, has not supported Iran at all, has opposed it, has supported terrorist activity against it. So we'll continue to see this on an increasing level for at least the short term, which is only going to bring suffering to countless numbers of people.
Well, Saad, I want to talk about the irony of, go back to 2001, the United States declares its war on terrorism. That, of course, wreaked havoc across the region and the world, to be honest. Fast forward now, 2023, and we're seeing more terrorist attacks. Many of them, a lot of people would say that the United States is behind. What has been accomplished in this so-called war on terrorism? And I want to talk about the significance of the U.S. using the tool of terrorism for themselves.
Yes, naturally, when a civilization starting its downfall and its demise, they will try to find tools and try to find means of reviving that civilization. We've seen this in the Roman Empire when it disintegrated, and other empires had the same fate when they became too fat and they couldn't fight anymore, they couldn't exist anymore and function correctly. And that's what's happening in the United States. The 2001 incident is probably, many scholars and many observers think that the Americans had a finger in that issue. And it wasn't only Al-Qaeda, which was, of course, Al-Qaeda did that, but they had consultation or maybe assistance from certain intelligence services. And that will indicate to us again in 2023 that the Americans will use the same tool because they have no other tools to use. They cannot revive their civilization through giving, through cooperation, through fair trade in the world, because that will completely undermine their industry, which is already in a big crisis. Industries are leaving America, going to China, going to other sources, and the Americans are finding there's a rise in unemployment, there's a rise in crime, and there's a full spectrum of issues, social issues, social upheaval in the United States. It's a It's a working economy, but with a disintegrated society, unlike what we have in some certain countries, which not a successful government, but we have a coherent societies. And that's what America lacks. So in a way, they're trying to, as I said, export their problems in a way that they could gather support for their actions and maybe help to revive their civilization.
Well, Robert, where do you see the situation going? Because on the one hand, if we're talking about, Assad has talked about this declining entity. On the other hand, we see the situation with the use of terrorism as a tool. So where do you see this going? As countries in the region hopefully continue their or increase their solidarity, and of course we have the resistance groups that are continually expanding and being active, where do you see all of this headed to?
The main problem is that the United States has an extremely powerful military. There are almost 900 military bases around the world from which the United States can launch attacks on any country that it chooses. So when countries elect leaders that lean socialist, that want to ally perhaps with Iran or China rather than the United States then feels threatened and will attack those countries. Other countries will use diplomacy. That's not something the United States has ever favored. It's always been the heavy hand, the military threat, and the military attack and intervention. I think, unfortunately, we're going to see more of this as more and more countries reject U.S. hegemony, reject the U.S. way of doing things, and can no longer be forced by the U.S. to do the U.S.'s bidding. So if the U.S. can't bribe them with a foreign aid, with trading in weaponry, the United States loves selling its deadly weapons around the world. If this isn't enough to induce these countries to do the U.S.'s bidding, then the U.S. will simply use its bombs to overthrow the government. I should say, not just its bombs, but also terrorist activities. The United States gets into wars very quickly, and the U.S. people are even tiring of this. But the United States will support organizations like ISIS and other organizations, as it has supported so many anti-Syrian organizations and caused untold suffering of the Syrian people. Syria seems to be in the last couple of years has made significant progress against this. But this is the way the United States operates and will continue to operate. And as it ceases to, or as its influence decreases in the world, it's going to cling harder to the tools that it has used in the past to maintain that influence, and that's terrorist activity and bombs.
Okay, and on that note, appreciate both of you being with me on this spotlight. Zayd al-Mutalibi, Iraqi politician and former political advisor to the Iraqi government out of Baghdad, and Robert Fantina, author and journalist out of Kitchener, Ontario. And thank you for being with us on another spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, how eating healthy can improve our Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It is such an honor to be here at your service, dear listeners. In today's episode of Islamic Lifestyle, we are talking about eating healthy and how it can improve our Islamic lifestyle. Now, we live in an age of fast food, snacks, chips, sodas, pop drinks, right? This is what it seems to be out there. For the most part, people are indulging in these kind of foods, and these foods are not only very high in fat, they're also very high in trash. to be very honest with you. This is not healthy food, and so if it's not healthy food, it is unhealthy food. And unhealthy food, especially these kind of foods, are really trash for the body. And so if we look at the human being, now what are we talking about? We're talking about how to expand and improve our Islamic lifestyle based upon eating healthy. So if we eat trash, that trash will, you know, be broken down by our body. It will be turned into blood. It will be turned into muscle. It'll be turned into, you know, tissues and all these other kind of things. So we're building our physical body with trash. And a human being, as we were about to say, is built up of various different aspects, and all these different aspects come together and create this existent being known as a human being. Now, one of those is the spirit, the ruh. Another one is the nafs, the carnal self, and the other one is the body. Now, if any one of these is diseased, if any one of these has ailments, has a problem, has a handicap, you know, then what's going to happen is it has an effect on everything else. So if we want to live a spiritual Islamic lifestyle, but we want to, you know, fill our bellies with trash food, then these two are not going to be in sync with one another. And that, of course, is going to cause problems in our Islamic lifestyle. Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are talking about how to increase and improve and expand our Islamic lifestyle based upon eating healthy. Now, we will not give credit to the secular world or the non-religiously affiliated world or the Western world or the capitalist world or, you know, these other kind of non-divine systems for coming up with the eating healthy motto. Matter of fact, we will give due credit to where it is due. The eating healthy model and the eating healthy motto and the eating healthy lifestyle is an Islamic lifestyle, and it is based upon the divine commandments that the Almighty God has given to every single one of his at least 124,000 prophets through the ages up to the present day. This is a divine command, and this command and this motto originated from the divine and nowhere else. So when we're talking about eating healthy, we had said how if we don't eat healthy, our physical body will start to be composed of this kind of fast food, you know, trash, garbage, and that this is going to not be in sync with our spiritual Islamic lifestyle. So our physical Islamic lifestyle, which includes eating healthy, is a very important part, and it has a direct effect upon our spiritual Islamic lifestyle. And just to kind of give an example, before we run out of time on the program, this is why we are told and we are prohibited from eating things that are haram, things that are prohibited, whether it is things that have been killed without the name of Allah being recited upon them, or things which are killed in a un-Islamic manner, or things that are outright haram, such as pigs and flesh of swine, or catfish, or fish that, you know, don't have scales, and these kind of things. Why? Because these kind of types of food, they have a negative impact not only on the human body, but also on the spiritual self. And so we're going to have to eat healthy if we want to expand and increase our Islamic lifestyle.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavet, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
On the 17th anniversary of the 2006 Israeli war against Lebanon, Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah underlined the prospects of the resistance front in the entire region.
I do not deny, as the Israeli war minister threatened, that they can take Lebanon back to the Stone Age. But I tell our enemy, based on evidence and facts, you also will be taken to the Stone Age. If you choose to go to war with Lebanon, you will be returned to the Stone Age. Our enemy can make a list of civilian and military obvious infrastructure in the area of occupied Palestine. They can calculate how many rockets the resistance needs to destroy all of these sites.
The Hezbollah leader stressed that the resistance in Lebanon and Palestine and the resistance alliance of the region have seized the initiative to a very high extent.
August 14, 2006 did not only signal the end of 33 days of Israeli hostilities, but it ushered in a new phase in the Israeli-Arab conflict. For the first time since its creation, Israel has been deterred from launching a new aggression for 17 years.
Western and Israeli reports published since the end of the 2006 war and until today mentioned that Hezbollah had a decisive victory over Israel with a lasting impact.
Any Western who was has a freedom or was liberal to say the truth would do nothing but acknowledge the truth about the resistance and honor them, because in their books and their reports they acknowledge that those people performed very highly and they were not scared, and they were facing the tanks and the airplanes and all of this with their humble weapons. But as the other brother said, but they had a spirit that the Israeli will never have, because they're fighting for good cause.
Observers believe the war has set the cornerstone for a new age for the peoples of this region and the whole world.
What this victory has done to the mentalities is building a new way of thinking, way of victorizing against the enemies, especially the West and its culture. They cannot invade us again.
Israel's aggression killed around 1,300 Lebanese, mostly civilians. It destroyed thousands of residential buildings and houses and severely damaged Lebanese civil infrastructure and displaced approximately 1 million Lebanese. Maryam Saleh, Mlita, South Lebanon.
Groundwater pollution has reached an alarming level in the Gaza Strip. The enclave's coastal aquifer is almost completely polluted with various contaminants, posing grave risks for Gazans. Israel has imposed tight restrictions on the entry of badly needed equipment to maintain water and sewage systems and targeted them during wars. Water pollution poses serious health risks throughout the tiny coastal sliver.
The Israeli continuous blockade has severe implications on the situation of water in Gaza. 97% of the Gaza aquifer water is polluted due to the destruction happened on the last offensives that we witnessed in Gaza Strip.
More than 2 million Gazans are forced to buy filtered water in order to cook or drink. Tap water in Gaza is unfit for human consumption. People only use it for house cleaning and doing the laundry.
Tap water is not suitable for drinking, and I think it's not even good for animals to drink. Tap water makes us sick, and we only use it to wash our clothes and to clean the house. My family spends a lot of money to buy filtered water. We only use filtered water to cook and drink.
Inhumane Israeli practices have taken their toll on the coastal sliver's drinking water. Water contamination levels are at least three times higher than the standards of the World Health Organization for safe drinking water.
More than 97% of Gaza's groundwater is polluted and does not meet the standards of the World Health Organization. The blockade and repeated Israeli military operations and the direct targeting of Gaza's vital infrastructure have also caused damage to water systems and affected water supply networks, further exacerbating the already existing water crisis.
The consumption of contaminated water at levels over international safety standards can cause potentially life-threatening diseases.
Years of Israeli siege and multiple wars since 2008 have devastated Gaza's water infrastructure and led to increasing levels of pollution in drinking water supplies. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Afghan women's restaurant is situated in the capital, Kabul, and serves traditional Afghan food. The restaurant is decorated with colorful fabrics, handicrafts, and flowers, and it is known for being run by and for women. The owners say it is a safe haven for women who want to enjoy a meal, socialize, and express themselves freely.
This restaurant is established to serve and help women. All of our employees and customers are women. We wanted to create a space where women can feel comfortable and hopeful and enjoy tasty Afghan traditional food. It's also aimed at offering jobs to women who are left without an income.
The women who work at the facility say they started working here after the Taliban banned them from other jobs and education. They call on the de facto government to reverse the restrictions on women's rights.
I was a student of law when the Taliban enforced the ban on universities. At the time, I felt so bad and depressed. In addition, our family was running out of money. Then I decided to join this restaurant. It is very beneficial and helpful for me. I call on the Taliban to restore our rights to work and education.
The restaurant is popular among women who come here to enjoy the food and the atmosphere. The customers say they appreciate the service and the solidarity that they find here.
I am a 12th grade student. I visit this restaurant because it is run by and for women. I come here to study, have Afghan hand-baked food, and socialize with my friends. I also want to meet new people and chat with them. I'm happy that at least we have this opportunity and service.
The restaurant is a rare example of women's empowerment and resistance in a country where the Taliban have imposed strict restrictions on women's rights. Despite the challenges and risks, Afghan women are not giving up on their dreams and aspirations. They are supportive of each other in the face of the imposed restrictions. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Years after their forced displacement during the Nakba, Palestinian refugees are concerned about the dire financial crisis facing the UNRWA. Since its establishment in 1949 by the UN General Assembly, UNRWA has dedicated all its effort to help protect the Palestinian refugees by providing humanitarian services and supporting their education. 2023 marks the most dangerous year for over 5 million Palestinian refugees spread across the occupied territories, Jordan, Lebanon, and other countries.
UNRWA's financial crisis started since signings of the Oslo Accord. It is mainly a political crisis, not financial, aroused by the U.S. administrations and the EU. The crisis is worsening every year, especially in Gaza. The donor countries have defunded and stopped their aids.
Here is where Hatem Mehjez, a Palestinian refugee, father of eight, was born after his father was displaced. He and his family are facing a serious situation because of the shrinking of UNRWA's essential services.
After my father's passing, I continue to live with the same suffering. The UNRWA's food supplies are not sufficient anymore. I beg my neighbors to feed us because I can't support my family. I can't work due to the health issues. My wife is also ill, and the UNRWA's medical centers, which are responsible for providing health care to us, don't provide her with the medications needed.
Talking about the shrinking supplies, Hatem is expressing his concerns about the future of his sons, who couldn't afford to marry and have their own families, as they are trying to work hard to support their younger siblings.
My sons can barely find work due to Gaza's disastrous situation amid the prolonged Israeli blockade and the rapidly rising fuel and food prices. They can hardly manage to get cooking gas and electricity. Sometimes on days like today, we don't find food on our table the whole day.
The politicization of the Palestinian refugees' plight jeopardizes the lives of over 1.2 million people in the Gaza Strip. The international community must shoulder their responsibilities towards the Palestinian refugees who were forcibly displaced from their original lands. Palestinian refugees continue to suffer since they were displaced back during the Nakba in 1948 by the Israeli occupation. The current UNRWA's financial crisis is harming thousands of Palestinian refugee families in Gaza whose only hope is not to go hungry. Al Al-Asib, Gaza.
People rallied in the Gaza Strip following Friday prayers in solidarity with Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque. Palestinians decried the Israeli crimes in Al-Quds and in the occupied West Bank. In recent weeks, settlers backed by Israeli forces have repeatedly violated the sanctity of Al-Quds. Israeli forces also carry out daily attacks in the occupied West Bank. They have killed some 200 Palestinians since the beginning of this year. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas, which organized the rally, warned the Israeli regime of the consequences of violations in Al-Quds and in the occupied West Bank.
The Palestinian people and the resistance are closely monitoring the aggression of the Zionist regime against Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque. We will not sit idly by while extremist settlers desecrate Al-Aqsa Mosque, and we're willing to sacrifice our lives for it. The resistance will intensify, and Israeli crimes in the occupied West Bank will not go unpunished.
Palestinians maintain that continued Israeli violations against Al-Aqsa Mosque will only lead to more resistance against the occupation.
Israeli policies in Al-Quds are aimed at ethnically cleansing Palestinians and turning Al-Aqsa Mosque into a Jewish temple. As we rally today, we call on all Muslims to defend Al-Quds because it belongs to all Muslims and Arabs.
For decades, Al-Quds has been at the core of the Palestinian struggle for justice and freedom.
We came out today to support Al-Aqsa Mosque and the resistance in the occupied West Bank. Al-Quds is in our heart, and we will always fight for the sake of Al-Quds. Al-Quds needs real action from all Muslims in order to protect it.
Al-Aqsa Mosque is Islam's third holiest site and has been under Israeli occupation since 1967, while Palestinians consider Al-Quds as the capital of their future state.
Palestinians in the besieged coastal territory say that they will use all forms of resistance against the Israeli occupation until the liberation of Al-Quds. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
The 15th Iran-South Africa Joint Commission in Pretoria has wrapped up with 26 cooperation agreements drafted and waiting to be finalized when Iran's president travels to South Africa later in autumn. Another sign of growing ties between the two countries that already enjoy close relations and have always supported each other during hard times.
One of the duties of Iran's South Africa Joint Commission is to come up with solutions to help establish peace and prosperity for nations in Africa and Asia. Moreover, we have high hopes for the outcome and achievements of this commission meeting in enhancing bilateral relations.
The Joint Economic Commission has proven to be more than just that, with shared views on international developments, which confirm Iran's foreign minister's comments when he said great steps have been taken to consolidate relations in various areas. But considering the geopolitical position of the Islamic Republic of Iran and the Republic of South Africa, with Iran eyeing a BRICS membership, it seems that the commonalities might lead to stronger relations than what it's been defined by the Joint Commission. Ties that may transcend the realms of bilateral cooperation in a world where more and more countries have expressed their frustration with Western hegemony and U.S. unilateralism.
Dear Minister, you know we are important members of what is termed the Global South. Both our countries are members of the Non-Aligned Movement. Our two nations support multilateralism and thus appreciate the role of the United Nations as the premier multilateral institution, while also advocating strongly for the reform of the United Nations, particularly the role and composition of the United Nations as Security Council.
With the Iranian president expected to pay two separate visits to South Africa, one to attend the BRICS Plus summit on August 24th and another to finalize the 26 cooperation agreements that were drafted by the 15 Joint Commission, prospects of a significant alliance are now stronger than ever. South Africa is considered an important country of the African continent, and the Islamic Republic of Iran has enjoyed warm relations with this country for decades. Now the Raisi administration wants these relations to go to the next level, achieving their full potential, all in line with a new multipolar world order that is emerging. Kisumisha Ahmadi, Pretoria.
The Sana'a government is accusing the Saudi-led coalition of exacerbating the humanitarian crisis in Yemen through what it called the illegal blockade on Sana'a International Airport. Before the war was launched against Yemen, over 6,500 passengers were able to fly in and out of Sana'a International Airport per day. However, that number has drastically been reduced to only 900 passengers per week due to the blockade imposed on the country. Because of these restrictions, many sick Yemenis have died since they were not able to fly out of the country in time to seek proper medical treatment. And that's mainly because the Saudi coalition only allows three flights into Sana'a Airport per week, a move which violates last year's ceasefire agreement, which stipulated airport restrictions would be lifted. According to the director of Sana'a Airport, Khaled Ashaif, these days Sana'a Airport is mainly used by UN flights for diplomatic purposes only.
After the ceasefire agreement was signed, Sana'a International Airport was supposed to resume flights from Jordan and Egypt. Unfortunately, the Saudi coalition did not meet its end of the deal. They only allowed flights from Jordan, and these flights were limited to three per week instead of the agreed six flights. I would like the world to know that Sana'a International Airport remains closed. As you can see, the only flights available are those belonging to the United Nations.
Because of limited flights into Sana'a, over 2,500 Yemenis remain stranded in Amman, Jordan.
We are living here in the streets of Amman, as you can see. There are many here who are also stranded and paying ridiculous prices for plane tickets. The prices for Yemen tickets are the most expensive in the world.
Ahmed Ashaf, a Yemeni-British citizen, received news that his mother was ill in Yemen. He was forced to book a flight and try to fly back home as soon as possible. But instead, he was stranded in Amman, Jordan, for 3 weeks.
After I got news that my mother was sick and was taken to intensive care, I needed to fly back to Sana'a immediately. Instead, I was stranded for 3 weeks, unable to visit her. This is a sad and tragic reality. When I finally arrived at Sana'a Airport, I spoke with many of other Yemenis who also suffered in Amman Airport and other airports around the world because they cannot fly back home due to their restrictions.
The Sana'a government continues to urge the Saudi-led coalition to abide by the ceasefire agreement and open Sana'a Airport. Otherwise, all options are on the table. Yusuf Mari, Sana'a.
Limelight. Systematic abuse by Zionist settlers has displaced yet another Palestinian community. Dozens of families from the Qabun hamlets were forcibly transferred from their ancestral homes. They're not the first. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. Middle East Eye wrote, during 1970s, the seeds of Israeli regime settlement enterprise took root in the southern Al-Khalil region as it voraciously consumed vast stretches of Palestinian land. The expansion then extended its tendrils toward the pristine landscapes of Masafer Yatta, transforming these idyllic areas into Zionist settlements. In defiance of multiple verdicts issued by the Zionist regime courts mandating the eviction of these communities, the Palestinian residents say they will stand firm, unwavering in their commitment to remain. In response, the Zionist regime has unshackled its settlers and troops, unleashing a campaign of oppression to force their departure. A Palestinian man told Middle East Eye, settler incursions onto our lands and sporadic assaults have become grimly routine. Our livestock are pilfered and on one occasion brutally slain. They obstruct our movements and restrict our access, while the troops storm our dwellings under the guise of hunting smugglers and those lacking permits. Destruction of property and physical abuse marked by beatings and derogatory language have become our daily ordeal. The Israeli regime assault on Bedouin territories isn't a recent phenomenon, but a battle that has persisted over many years. Soheil Khaliliyeh, director of the Settlement Monitoring Unit at the Applied Research Institute in Al-Quds, ARIJ, shed light on the plan for the expulsion of Bedouin populations in East Al-Quds, paving the way for the realization of the E1 project, part of the Greater Al-Quds Expansion Scheme. Khaliliyeh told MEE, "For over 2 decades, Israel has articulated into intention to sterilize the region east of Al-Quds, the southern Al-Khalil zone, and the vicinity of the Jordan Valley. Using a term frequently used by Israeli regime authorities in reference to the expulsion of Bedouins," he added, "this strategic maneuver is designed to displace the Bedouin communities, confining them to prescribed enclaves. The reality far surpasses what the media portrays. The ongoing battle against them is fierce, characterized by Israel's utilization of every conceivable tactic to forcibly expel them." As per the 2017 statistics unveiled by the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Human Rights Affairs in the Occupied Palestinian Territories, OCHA, a stark reality emerges regarding the potential forced displacement of 46 Bedouin communities in the central West Bank. Of these communities, 26 find themselves within the jurisdiction of Al-Quds Governorate. A total of 4,856 Bedouin. These people grappled with dire living conditions, marked by severe deficits in fundamental services like water and electricity. Their challenges are further compounded by limited access to essential educational and healthcare facilities. The data furnished by the UN underscores that over 70% of the residents within these communities are refugees who were expelled by the Zionist regime in 1948 from their original homes in Southern-occupied Palestine. A staggering 90% of them rely on livestock grazing as their primary source of livelihood. Most of their homes have been marked for demolition, with a staggering 85% lacking access to both water and electricity. Khalile pointed out that Israel's approach includes an array of distressing tactics, including the demolition of homes and schools, the senseless killing of livestock, the relentless harassment of shepherds and farmers, the deliberate burning of crops, violent physical assaults that can be deadly, the sabotage of wells, and obstructing the building of crucial infrastructure. These calculated methods, the ARIJ claims, unequivocally amount to the crime of ethnic cleansing. Khalile said, the Palestinian Bedouin communities stand as an impediment to the expansion of settlements. Consequently, they endure these brutal assaults with impunity. The systematic abuse faced by Bedouins in the West Bank mirrors the atrocities committed against the Bedouins in the Naqab and Bir al-Sabah in occupied Palestine during 1948. According to Wafa News Agency, in July, the Israeli regime occupation authorities and forces demolished, confiscated, or force people to demolish 54 structures in East Al-Quds and Area C of the West Bank, including 20 homes, citing the lack of Israeli-issued building permits, which are almost impossible to obtain, and killed 10 Palestinians, according to the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA, in the occupied Palestinian territory. As a result of the demolitions, 66 Palestinians, including 34 children, were displaced, and the livelihoods of more than 795 others were affected, it said in its Protection of Civilians report covering the period between July 5th and 24th. 16 of the affected structures were provided by donors in response to previous demolitions. 15 out of those 16 structures were demolished in a single incident in Al-Montar, in the Al-Quds Governorate, and another structure was demolished in Beit Jala, near Beit Lahm. According to the report, 80% of the affected structures were in Area C. The remaining 11 structures were demolished in East Al-Quds, including 9 residential structures, resulting in the displacement of 5 households comprising 24 people, including 12 children. 8 out of the 11 structures demolished in East Al-Quds were destroyed by their owners to avoid the payment of fines to the Zionist regime authorities. و Buffer News Agency added Israeli regime authorities demolished two agricultural-related structures in Area C of Birin near Bani Naim in Al-Khalil Governorate, allegedly for trespassing estate land. On July 11th, the Zionist regime forces forcibly evicted the elderly Qaith Sob Laban Palestinian couple from their home in the old city of Al-Quds after their protected tenancy was terminated by Israeli regime courts. Following their eviction, their home was immediately handed over to the Zionist settlers. The United Nations Office for the High Commissioner for Human Rights in the occupied Palestinian territories stated that the Zionist laws used to evict the family are inherently discriminatory and in violation of the Zionist regime's human rights obligations. According to OCHA assessments, approximately 1,000 Palestinians are at risk of forced eviction in East Al-Quds, mainly due to court cases initiated by settler groups. In addition, 8 households were displaced from